I cannot resist the temptation. Call me Ishmael. Because we're heading deep to the bottom of the sea to talk about sperm whales, the Moby Dick kind of whale. To get us there, we're joined by Hel Whitehead. Hel's a professor at Canada's Dalhousie University, a marine biologist and a world-leading expert on these magnificent creatures. He spent decades studying them from his sailboat, and he's written several books and umpteen papers about them. His most recent research involved studying the logbooks of 19th century whalers, and Hel and his fellow researchers came up with some quite fascinating findings about the creatures. Hel's on the blower from Nova Scotia. Welcome to Late Night Live, Hel.
Good evening, Phil.
You have been studying them for, well, decades, heading out to sea each year in a sailing boat with fellow researchers. I understand they've got the biggest brains and the biggest noses of any animals, and that they live in female-led families. Tell me more about these creatures.
Well, they're extreme in so many ways, and you've mentioned a couple of them, but one other one that might intrigue the listeners is they have the greatest geographic difference between the sexes of any species. The females and the young live in the tropics and subtropics, whereas the males are in the Arctic and Antarctic. So that's another weird one. So, but their society is built upon these family groups of females, and those are what I've spent quite a lot of my life following around and trying to figure out the intricacies of their social system. And it's intriguing for me, but it's vital for them.
So we now know that they live in this female-led family structure, and they're essentially a babysitting culture, Hel.
Yes, well, we think that that's the basis of it. So sperm whales dive deep under the ocean, hundreds of meters, sometimes over 1,000 meters, to get their food, which are these rather mysterious deep water squid. And their young can't dive as deep as they do or for as long as they do, and are so left at the surface where they're potentially vulnerable to maybe a big shark, a killer whale. And so they babysit each other's young. They take turns diving, and the young moves from mom to auntie to older sister to so on.
And how many babies might there be in a nursery?
Oh, they have an extremely low reproductive rate. So each female is giving birth, in the best of times, once every 4 years. And there's only about 10 or so animals in one of these family groups. So often just one, sometimes two. Occasionally, and it's a delight to see this, three or four, and you can see the calves playing together. So just a couple. Usually.
Let's go back to these large proboscis of theirs. Yes, the nose is huge. It's filled with oil, which is why they were hunted in the past. But they don't sing like other whales, do they?
No, they don't. This nose is the is a sonar system. It makes the most powerful sounds of any animal. Loud clicks, and that's what the sperm whale uses to find its food deep under the ocean. But it also uses these clicks to communicate with other sperm whales, and they do this making Morse code-like patterns of clicks. And this, by listening to these patterns, and we've begun to get an insight into how they arrange their societies.
Hel, do you think we might eavesdrop on some? And here's some clicks now. Here we go. Now. In what passes for modern journalism these days, we're always talking about clickbait, and that's a, and there's clickbait of a completely different sort. What's going on?
Well, there are a number of things going on, and that clip illustrates a lot of the different sides to the sperm whale. In the background, there's a sort of low rumbling set of lot of whales clicking at the same time. And this is the whales deep underwater looking for squid. Each one is going click, 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 listening for echoes from their potential food. On top of that, you hear creaks, sort of buzzes, and we don't know exactly what's going on there, but these are whales at the surface. They're quite loud buzzes, and they may be buzzing off the boat, so they're keeping track of us. But the part of it that most intrigues me are these patterns of clicks, and perhaps your listeners heard them. They were making what we call 3+1s, click, 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 a little pause before the last one. And this is characteristic of a particular, what we call clan of sperm whales, who make this pause before the last click in the pattern, the plus one clan. And they live in an area of the eastern tropical Pacific around the Galapagos Islands and other waters around there. And they have a particular way of life. And that way of life is signaled by this pattern of clicks.
You've discovered five clans of eastern Pacific sperm whales through these codes and believe there are many more out there. I think you know of five clans from the eastern Pacific. Where else are they to be found?
Well, sperm whales are found right around the globe. So pretty much everywhere, the waters are deep enough, over a kilometer for them. So we have done studies in the eastern Pacific, and we're currently assimilating work that other people have done and putting it together with ours from right around the Pacific. So Taylor Hirsch, the graduate student who works with me, has formed collaborations with scientists in Japan, in British Columbia, in Hawaii, New Zealand, and is trying to get a much more detailed picture of how things work for the sperm whales in the Pacific. We've also worked in the Caribbean, where we've identified three clans working around the islands of the Eastern Caribbean.
And meanwhile, the fathers are vanishingly remote. They're a long, long way away.
Yes, that's correct.
When do they meet to collaborate?
Well, it looks as though the breeding season is quite variable. There is a preferred season in each bit of the ocean, but it varies and it's quite long. And so what seems to happen, this is a part of sperm whale life we know rather little about. The male sperm whales, who's huge now, he's three, the females are big ladies, they're 11 tons or so, but the males, mature males, three times that, 33 or so tons. He moves from his normal haunts, which might be off Greenland or Antarctica, down into the tropics. And he may be there, we're not sure, but for a few weeks, a few months. And he swims around between the groups of females. And we've watched this because we follow the groups of females. And sometimes the male comes in, this enormous creature, really impressive. And the females seem to have no interest whatsoever in him. They just dive and go off. And you think of the poor guy saying, God, I swam all the way to here and no one's interested.
There's so much to cover and so little time, but one of the things that's absolutely fascinating about what you've co-authored with Luke Rendell is that you've now got good reason to suspect that the sperm whales developed the ability to warn each other about whalers.
Yes, that's right. So those differences between the clans that I mentioned seem to, well, we're sure, are cultural. They're things the baby sperm whale learns from its mother and passes on to its offspring when she grows up. But this has been hard to find, these instances of culture. And so we look for another possible instance. And this is the sperm whales reacting to a huge change in their environment. And this is a change that happened in the 1820, around then, in the North Pacific, when the Moby Dick whalers appeared in their environment. These were things they'd never seen before. People in open boats trying to kill them. And so we looked at the records of these whalers, which fortunately have been kept very carefully and now digitized, and found that the success of the whalers in killing the whales that they'd sighted, the ones they'd actually seen, went down by about 50% over the first 3 to 5 years that the whalers were in the North Pacific. So the whales seem to have figured out a way of avoiding the whalers very quickly. And it looks like the only way this can have happened is that they were learning from each other.
And so, you point out they also learnt defence techniques like deep diving.
Exactly, yes. So they learnt techniques of having been seen by the whaler and whalers and approached by them of avoiding being killed. And that would include deep diving, swimming fast upwind. The whalers were surprised by this. How do the whales know that this is a good thing to do? Because the whalers were rowing, and if you've rowed in the ocean, it's very hard to row upwind. So the whales caught on very quickly and figured out ways to avoid the whalers.
There's a difficulty these days, isn't there, the state of the whales in your part of the world, because the Inuit, the Aboriginal people in the north, kill whales and continue to do so as a part of their traditional lives.
Yes, it's something that really most of us here in Canada don't pin on the Inuit. The problem is the rest of us and our ancestors who went there and slaughtered the whales and reduced the numbers so far. And nowadays it's due to the other things that we are doing to the oceans, the noise we're putting in, the fact that we're building mines up in the Arctic and there's resultant all kinds of shipping. So the numbers currently that are killed by the Inuit are, as far as we can tell, sustainable. They kill fewer than are being replaced by natural reproduction. But the big concern is that the huge changes that are occurring to the Arctic at the moment due to global warming and due to the secondary effects of that, the ships that go through and so on.
How serious and urgent a threat is global warming?
It's a very serious and urgent threat to pretty much all life on Earth and in the ocean. And in some respects, the whales have it a bit better than trees or animals which can move very little or have very restricted habitat. They can move around. They can learn from each other potential ways to change their way of living to survive these threats. But there's only a limit to that. After a while, it becomes impossible to adapt.
Now, Herman Melville explains the love affair between Captain Ahab and a sperm whale. How did you fall in love with these creatures?
Well, I fell in love with them. I went out to find them first because when I was young, and to some extent still, I used studying whales as an excuse to go deep water sailing, which I desperately love. But when I got out there, I got captivated by them. The intricacies of their social system, the combination of an animal that lives most of its life in a very mysterious world far beneath the ocean, and then comes up and is sort of visible to us for a while, and there lives its social life, where we can start to try and get a glimpse of this remarkably intricate soap opera that is their
lives. But getting a glimpse is damn difficult, as professional whalers of the Ahab era discovered, and you discover it, of course, when you're out on trying desperately to locate them.
Absolutely, yes. So off the Galapagos, where we found most of our insights, you know, sometimes we sail around for 2 weeks and never see a sperm whale. So, and for the whalers, it was even longer. So, yeah, it's a frustrating business at times, but the rewards are wonderful.
Is there any evidence that they're curious about you, Al?
Mostly not. We try, I mean, I'm trying to study their natural life, so we try and stay far enough from them so that we're not interfering in their lives. And mostly we succeed, but it's not always that way. And sometimes, especially immature, juvenile animals can become interested in us, and they come around the boat, and you can hear their rapid clicks assessing us, and it's quite wonderful.
I think you're a very fortunate fellow, Hal Whitehead. Really, what a wonderful life you are having, in seeking such information about whale culture. I've been talking to Hal Whitehead, marine biologist extraordinaire. He's a professor at Dalhousie University in Canada and an all-round whale expert. When I say all-round, I'm sure he's quite slender himself, and his proboscis is no larger than normal. Hal, thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you, Phil. It's been a great joy.